RCR with Paul Brennan.
So, to proposed health reforms for our country, focusing on prevention and chronic disease management and mental health. Joining RCR, I think this is our first chat for this 2025 year, Professor Grant Schofield. Nice to have you back.
Hey, Paul.
We've had some good chats about the state of our health, and we've sort of riffed over those chats. Well, I've asked you what we can do to kind of turn the tide and get on a better direction in terms of improving the nation's health. And, you know, it's hard not to feel slightly depressed about all of that, particularly when you see the emphasis on what many people, including you, call our sickness, current sickness system, which clearly isn't delivering health outcomes that we would want. So you've decided to do something about it. It's about time someone did. First of all, do you want to just go through a bit of that, and then we can go through what is needed to change that direction and actually get some runs on the board, let me put it that way.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is the world fundamentally changed with one man's actions, and that was Bobby Kennedy, RFK Jr.'s move from a Democrat to a more centrist position, and then joining in now with his Make America Healthy Again. Now, it's very easy to get caught in the I don't like Trump, I do like Trump, you know, all of the US politics. But by far the bigger picture there is you now actually had someone who's got some leverage, which actually, you know, almost all of the Americans agree on, which is a really an interesting situation because that never happens, of course. And it's been around saying if it's not health that we're after, what are we after in society? When you're in rich societies like New Zealand, we're still teetering there, then why are we not investing resources in the things that most people consider important for their life? And that's staying healthy in the first place. And so the sort of executive orders that have been issued now in the US, when you actually read through the details of those, they're astonishingly clear and astonishingly good. And so I've read through those and gone, hey, we actually need to, someone needs to stand up in New Zealand and bring health back onto our political agenda. Now, I'm not a politician, so how does one in a social democracy engage in that? So what I've done is gone and written what I think is a comprehensive set of plans with background and then actions around what New Zealand needs to do in terms of health reform and where we would put budget, what we would allocate things towards. And then I've started that as a parliamentary petition. That's how a social democracy works, and that's what I'm into. I'd preface that by saying, you know, across three things. We've got this chronic disease epidemic of diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and then the sort of ongoing things around Alzheimer's and neurological and dementia-type issues. We've got a mental health crisis that's unprecedented, particularly in our young people and we're the adults in society, and we can talk more about that in a moment.
Yeah.
And we've gone down a pharmaceutical track where we've ended up with a pill for every ill, and the only real thing you can expect from either secondary care in hospital is to fix yourself up if you're injured, which is great, or a medicine, which might or might not work and may do more harm than good on many occasions. And it's just not good enough.
Yeah, it's like hitting a dead end, isn't it, really? One of the points I picked up from what you're saying is that the majority of bad health is from non-communicable origins, right? So these are the things that happen to people. They're not catching it from other people. Yet we were prepared to spend a huge amount of money, billions, actually, as it turned out, for one thing that was communicable. Yet we're ignoring the underneath of the iceberg big time, which just fascinates me that we could have that sort of way of thinking.
It's just an astonishing thing. I think 90% of the burden of disease in New Zealand is what we call preventable or non-communicable. So that's, you know, just even on basic principles, you'd invest 90% of your money in that. And we sort of do because we catch this at the bottom of the cliff. We treat cancer when you've got cancer. We do something a little bit about diabetes when you've got that and so on and so forth. But the whole point about non-communicable diseases is that they're by and largely preventable. And of the 28 billion that we spend in health and managed with one Excel spreadsheet,
Yeah, what do you think of that, by the way? Because that seems like very loose, very prone to all sorts of things. It's hanging by a thread, and it doesn't enhance any feeling of confidence in the competence of the people running the show.
Well, I mean, put it this way, if you were a publicly traded company with that degree of financial management, you would be breaking the law, and the directors would be charged and presumably at some point jailed for financial mismanagement of that. First of all, they're running at massive loss, which no public company can. But the due diligence around finances with one spreadsheet in such a complex system and spending environment is just beggars belief, really. As I say, in any other part of society, you'd be breaking the law.
Okay, so allocation of resources to health. I think you say between 5 and 15% of the budget. Is that right?
Well, what I'm shooting for at the moment, I think if you talk about what, my catchphrase, of course, is prevention is cure, would much rather you didn't get these serious diseases, first of all, because they're no fun having them. Second of all, they cost loads of money. And third of all, they inconvenience a lot of other people. So the question is, what do we spend on preventing stuff? And the answer is probably less than 1%. And what we do call prevention is really only catching disease early. So you can get a breast cancer screen or cervical cancer screen and these types of things. And those do catch diseases early, and that's a good thing, but it's not preventing the disease in the first place. It's just catching it early. What we're talking about is a full prevention strategy. And I'm saying if we just allocated 10% of our health budget to prevention in terms of chronic disease, that would be $3 billion. That's 3 billion more than what we currently spend. And you go, where does the money come from? This is the big question for. Hang on, I'll allocate another 5% extra of the health budget to mental health as well, because at the moment it's an inhumane system. There's really no community care available to people. You can call the police on your relatives, which is sick, and then they can go into an in-care facility where it may not even be safe. So the thing is, around that sort of money, we haven't at all considered where we would get that from. So what are you going to stop doing? And this is the bit that people are going to have to get their head around. At the moment, we spend a third of our budget in health in the last 6 months of people's lives for care that they didn't want often, and care that most often makes little difference to their quality and quantity of life and often makes it worse. I'll just say that again because it's a very important thing. We spend a third of our health budget on people in the last 6 months of their life for care that they never wanted and they wouldn't have consented to if they'd been asked, for conditions where the treatment often makes no difference and often makes things worse. So we spend at perverse ends, and yet we're not prepared to spend on something that would prevent those problems in the very first place.
Again, the big question, why? Why a resistance when it's obvious? Is it because ultimately it's political, I guess? Is it because no politician wants to be the one, waving the finger in front of people, telling them that you've got to actually shape up ultimately on health and we've got to do this?
Yeah, I agree. People don't want to do that. Currently, our current health minister's big light bulb moment is that we've reduced people's wait time to get to a GP down to no more than a week, from the many weeks or months that it might take now. I suppose that's a good thing, but really, that's all you've got. That's literally going to make very little difference to our health, and that's the degree of imagination of our politicians and political environment. So, yep. We do have to confront the fact that we eat a lot of crappy food. We move less than we probably should, and we're going to have to sort of take that away and say, actually, you can spend and make a difference to that. And a lot of that is to do with the literacy of our health workforce. Our mainstream medicine workforce, especially our doctors, aren't trained in any of the factors that make a difference to your actual health around lifestyle, around behavioural aspects about how to help people deal with those things. So, the main aspect that you could do to help someone with their health is completely absent from medical school and other nursing college training, which is just bizarre if you think about it. And probably, Paul, I think this is the important thing, and this is why the United States is so important. In 1922, Rockefeller commissioned a thing called the Fresner Report. And the Fresner Report, backed by about one point, oh, about $150 billion in today's terms by Rockefeller, to dismantle the holistic general practice system in the US. So about 55% of practitioners in the US in that time were practicing what we would call holistic medicine. That was completely dismantled, and because of other industry conflicts, including oil, it turned into a pill for every ill system. And this wasn't by accident that this pharmaceutical system dominates world medicine now. And it's had some really good benefits, but not anti-medicines. But what it's had is it's completely excluded a way of keeping people healthy.
Because it also serves the purpose of not having to, I don't know how you describe it, persuade people to be disciplined about how they lead their lives. It's easier just to let people freewheel, right, and have the pill at the backstop. But you still want to be going through those drive-throughs every night and so on. No one's saying anything because it does require a certain amount of knowledge and discipline to improve health, right? At an individual level.
Well, I mean, as I say, choose your hard, because it's hard being sick from chronic disease. Life is actually not much fun. It's also hard work, exercising and eating right, and nobody's going to be perfect on that, least of all me. But what you do 80% of the time will define what your life looks like, and if you've got an 80% good attitude, you'll have a good life. There'll be some difficulty involved. That effort will be spent up front rather than down the back end. And just in a bigger picture, for everyone, I don't know if people think about this, but it occurred to me early in my life that having a good life is just as much as work as having a not a good life. It's just when you do the work. You can do the work on your own terms up front, or you can do the work on someone else's terms down the back. In actual fact, on the basis of pure laziness, you'd be in shape. Because it's actually slightly easier. So choose your hard is the first thing I'd say. The second thing is it's one of these old quotes, and I think it's a Chinese one from way back, but it's like, ask a healthy person what they're dreaming about and they'll have a thousand dreams. Ask an unhealthy person what they're dreaming about and they've just got one dream. So these are the conversations we've got to have as a society.
Want to talk about mental health for just a moment. Back to RFK Jr. One thing I've noticed because of his association with Trump, and you mentioned that before, but for example, in some of the comments from media stories on the social media in New Zealand that talk about him, if you don't like Trump, you don't like RFK. And what that has me thinking is that there are a lot of people out there, and it's the same people who are always talking about trusting the science as well, that are so persuaded into more an ideological perspective on their own health, which I don't see how that works out for anyone. So I wonder if he, maybe in America, but here in New Zealand, other countries around the world, will make that kind of impact on that sort of thinking. People have got to overcome the derangement syndrome of Trump.
Yeah, I mean, political centrism is now more or less absent in the world, and then that means that it's more or less absent now in science. And so science depends on centrism, therefore medicine depends on centrism, which is arguing everything on its pros and cons and doing that without this deep-seated derangement, as you call it. Now, RFK Jr., in my mind, has done a really good job. Is he going to be right on everything? The answer is no. But a classic example is this vaccine stuff at the moment, and people are going, well, look, he's an anti-vaxxer. And he has a history, probably in a community that might be labeled that. But exactly what he's saying now is like, no, we will hold every single thing that we're doing up to scientific scrutiny, and we'll look at its pros and cons, and we'll get people from across society to contribute that to that debate. Now, how can anyone possibly object to that sort of approach? That's exactly how you do this stuff. And if you leave it to the pharmaceutical companies, it's going to end badly, and that's the way it's going at the moment in the US and therefore in the rest of the world.
One of the figures that jumps out, I think it was him who originally put it out there, but Trump's been repeating it, and that is the autism rates. 30, 40 years ago, 1 in 36. Sorry, 1 in 10,000. Now 1 in 36. Now, I don't know how accurate those figures are, but even if they're near that, it's mind-blowing. Even that's not enough to switch people on to there being a problem.
Yeah, well, there's a problem of some sort, and we don't know exactly what that is.
Yeah, but
Like,
it's one hell of a problem, isn't it? I
yeah,
mean, look at the
100%. But as a medical community and the adults in society, we've got a responsibility to deal with this. And a study just came out on the weekend. You double your 2.5 times more chance of autism if the mother was eating a diet high in ultra-processed food. So there's
Yeah.
one part of the equation. It's not going to solve all those rates, but there's one contributing plausible factor. Take these things seriously.
On the mental health front, how did we get into this situation in numbers of people suffering in with their mental health? I've always thought that it's a relatively safe country to live in, and the necessities of life are on the whole there, and most people get a reasonable upbringing and all the toys that are around compared to when we were younger. Surely should make life more interesting and sort of more expansive, but no, it's people are, particularly young people, are struggling. Has sort of meaning in life fallen away, and how do you get that back?
Well, I think the first thing, Paul, is just to look at the magnitude of the change, because I think we know we've got a crisis. But if you just look at the data, it's an astonishing thing, especially for young women who are not talked about. So in 2005, we started measuring severe psychological distress in the New Zealand Health Survey. And it's a pretty robust way we do it. It's been going on for now 20 years. And at that time, 4% of 16 to 24-year-old men, young men, suffered severe psychological distress, and 6% of young women. So that's typically the ratio that they differ by. Now, that continued about the same until 2011, 2012, when in New Zealand, like the rest of the world, everything started tipping steeply upwards and is accelerating away from us. So in our last health survey, about 20% of young men suffer severe psychological distress, and 30% of young women. 30%. This is an astonishing thing. So the question is, what changed? Did we give them a lot more stress, or have other things changed in society? Now, one thing that we know has changed is the amount of time they spend on these small screens. You can expect us between a young person to be spending between 6 and 8 hours a day. And that's an astonishing change, and its effect on physiology, especially on that dopamine system, especially social media, probably gaming as well. You chuck in vaping, ultra processed food, that whole reward system is deeply dysregulated. So the system that's supposed to give you pleasure actually is now malfunctioning and causes pain. So that's one aspect of it. And that's often diagnosed as anxiety or depression, when in fact it's just a dysfunction of that reward system, and you have to just get off these devices, probably cold turkey. The second thing is, are we less able to withstand the exact same stresses? And the answer is probably, and one of the reasons is, we're way less active. And the sort of stress of being outside, exercising, and that builds a robust body, but it also builds a robust brain. They're not separate things. And so that's probably changed. So society looks a lot different. And again, why are we not willing to think about what we eat, how much we move, the devices and whatnot that we use? And actually, our main solution is pharmaceutical. And the fact is, and I think this will be a surprising thing to people, that antidepressant SSRI medicines, 80% of their effect, of their small positive effect, is placebo. And this is the drug company's own data, right? So you do a randomized trial, people get allocated to the sugar pill or the antidepressant, and the difference between the effect of the sugar pill and the antidepressant is barely 1 point on a 50-point depression scale. And they cause harm, like suicidal ideations, particularly in young people, sleep loss, and other things. And that's our go-to. Like, what the hell are we thinking as a society? How is this even a thing?
Yeah, I guess it's easy to make a bit of money just by writing a prescription. Maybe that's another
Well, I
chat.
mean, the system's not set up for it, right? Well, you go into your doctor, you've got 10 minutes. I'm not feeling that great, doctor. What tools has your doctor got besides a prescription? The answer is nothing.
Oh, okay, well, let's then, because we come up against time, what's your vision then of, in your fit-for-purpose health system, at GP level? I come into the GP, I want more time. Number one, do I? Do I want more time with the GP? I don't want just 10 minutes, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. I need to get at least half an hour, 40 minutes. Would that be...
Yeah, half an hour is great. There's a brutal reality around that, Paul, because we're losing our general practice workforce. So these are people who've joined because they care. They're doing 35, 40 appointments a day. It's a brutal job where you're burnt out. You ask a GP, 50% of them say they don't want to be doing this in 5 years' time. And a good portion won't be because they would have retired. So we're not going to have more GPs with more time. So what we've been doing over the last several years is using these health coaches. So you can train people up, they can spend an hour with you, and they can do that over several weeks at a much lower cost. And they're going to work with the GP. The GP is going to be at the top of their game. They're going to be de-prescribing, taking you off your meds. They're going to be handing over, referring you, and someone's going to be working with you on your behavioral stuff, asking you what's important, listening to you, and helping you stop your smoking. And we've been pretty good at that. Drink less, eat better, exercise
Well,
more.
we've only been good at that. Sorry for jumping in, because the message was hammered for years and years. It was okay to hammer that message. That was okay. But we can't seem to hammer any other message.
Yeah, we can. That's a really good point. Actually, I hadn't been thinking much about that. But yeah, we accepted that smoking wasn't working for us, and we should do something about it. We've got to get there on the booze. We've got to get there on the ultra processed junk food. We've got to get there on the exercise and the sleep and the devices, and we haven't.
All right. So how long do you think it would take to turn around? Is this something in our, obviously wanted to have it in our lifetime. I suppose once you get onto it, it's probably not a too much of a huge deal, really. It's pretty obvious and logical what needs to happen.
Yeah, well, you're not going to turn around at all unless you start investing at least a portion. And if I'm saying 10 to 15% of our health budget goes towards this type of activity, we're still sending 85% in the sickness system. I'd far rather turn it exactly the other way. That's not going to realistically happen. So we start spending money. 10 years, we're going to turn it around, but it's that long, which of course is three or 2.5 political cycles, depending on where we go. Which is far too long for any politician. But there's a actual reality to this. I don't think our politicians have realized that the world has actually fundamentally changed in the last 2 months.
How do they miss that? Curious question. How do they miss this? Because on other issues, they're not reading the room too, which are laid bare and obvious by what's happened.
I think their source of news is still mainstream media. And if you're relying on that as your source of news, well, good luck with that. I mean, I was on X the other day, which I use a fair bit. It's really useful for my research. It's really useful for the science, but it's also really useful for a bunch of discussions across a range of things. A couple of people I hadn't seen for a while saw me on it, and they were like, "I can't believe you're on that. It's so bad. It's terrible." And I just, it's the opposite of
It's
that.
the only thing available.
So I don't know
The good,
where
honest.
you, yeah, where would you get your news otherwise? Hey, so back to this petition stuff then, Paul. So just to finish that bit off, so if people do want to support this, as we actually are supposed to be a functioning social democracy, then I've got it up on precure.com/petition, precure.com/petition. You can go and read my whole health reform doc there. You can link through to the government parliamentary website, you can sign your life away and show some support. But these things, my view at the moment is the only real route to radical change is going to come from the public, strongly bottom up. If you're waiting for the politicians just to get their act together and think sensibly, good luck.
It will happen inevitably, won't there? But it's just how bad it gets, because the system can't keep delivering like it
Well,
is.
I used to think we had a reasonably functioning sickness system, but even that's fallen apart now. So good luck with that.
Great to catch up again with you, Professor Grant Schofield, and good luck to you. We'll put those links with the replay of this. And I see kind of north almost of 1,500 signatures when I looked. I hope they update it regularly and that's not some sort of artifact figure. But, if our people can pile in and add to that,
yeah,
that would be good.
I'm going for 100,000, Paul. I only just started last week and I've got 3 months
Yeah.
to do it. So,
Well, that's okay.
yeah.
Well, you work out the growth rate per day on that one, what you need, like a
Yeah,
telephone
well, I'm
target.
relying on you guys out there in RCR land to get into it.
All right. Grant, thanks for coming back on, and we'll monitor it, and good effort. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.